Topic for tonight is the internal politics of the Six-Day War. So if last week we discussed the waiting period of May 14th to June 4th, today we'll discuss June 5 through June 10, the 6 days of the war, with little attention, or no attention paid really to the battlefield, but an attention paid to what the politicians were doing and thinking, and what their fears were as the war progressed. And those fears would evolve from concern about death and the demise of the country to how to deal with victory and what are the unpleasant consequences of winning. Okay. So, day one, May, June 5. To avoid war with Jordan, because after all, in the view of Moshe Dayan, and for that matter the rest of the cabinet, or most of the cabinet, this was a war against Egypt. Egypt had done several provocative things of closing the Straits of Tehran, of removing the United Nations emergency force, of militarizing the Sinai. They were being quite belligerent without actually stepping foot over the border. So this was this war was basically meant for just Israel and Egypt. It could have been a 1956 war all over again, except that on the northern front, the Syrians were saber-rattling and had been shelling the northern settlements for a while. And in the central sector, the Jordanians had signed a military pact with Egypt 5 days earlier. So it looked like this could be a three-front war, but if it could be avoided, then it's best to avoid a three-front war. So to avoid the war with Jordan, the IDF cancels its biweekly convoy to Mount Scopus. Now, Mount Scopus was an isolated enclave of Israeli rule that would be relieved every 2 weeks with a convoy of troops and policemen, but they were troops. And this was done away with. Various training exercises in the vicinity of Jerusalem were canceled, and even the magazines of the Uzis were taken out of the gun, just that you wouldn't have an accidental shot fired across the bow. You know, every measure was taken that we shouldn't go to war with Jordan if we could avoid it. The government sent personal appeals to King Hussein to show restraint. They sent them via the United States, the United Kingdom, and the United Nations representative in Israel, Od Bull, General Bull, who was the head of the emergency force.
Was it significant that France wasn't involved in that?
Not really. France is not a significant player at this point. They had been the supplier of arms to Israel, but they're not going to be relevant in the Six-Day War. Sending these appeals is something that Yigal Alon favored. Moshe Dayan actually opposed doing it because he said, doesn't King Hussein know he's not supposed to get involved in this fight? That was Dayan's argument. Doesn't he know better? Od Bull did not like Israel, and he did not want to pass along this message to King Hussein, so he said he had to consult New York before he could actually send on a message encouraging peace, which is not exactly the nicest thing for him to have done, but so be it. In any event, the Jordanians felt that they had to do something to show Arab solidarity, because if they did nothing, King Hussein would be seen as a loser, as a wimp, as someone who didn't stand up for Arab rights. And he could lose his kingdom if it were known that in the great moment of Arab victory versus the Zionists, he withdrew. So he needs to do something, but not too much. Because if he does too much, Israel's going to destroy him, and he could die. So he needs to fight only a little bit, just to get away with it. Well, his tactic is to try to occupy the Government House Ridge, which is today the Amon HaNetziv, southern Jerusalem. It was a fairly large swath of territory separating East Jerusalem and southwestern Jerusalem. So it's a demilitarized area, it's an international enclave, and Jordanian troops come in and take over. This could be very bad for Israel if the Jordanians are allowed to hunker down in the Government House area, because that overlooks the southern portions of the city.
Wasn't it the UN?
The UN had civilians there, had civilian employees.
They flew the UN flag.
They flew the UN flag, and there were about 50 UN employees who were in the house.
And Jordan took it over.
Yes. This is a big problem.
Huh?
No, they didn't shoot anybody. They're not interested in killing United Nations personnel. But the problem is, if they are able to secure this location, they can fan out from there to Katamon, to Talpiot, to other neighborhoods in southern Jerusalem, and the city could be exposed.
This is before Israel launched the airstrike.
No, this is roughly simultaneous with. The airstrikes start late in the 7 o'clock hour, close to 8 o'clock, and the Egyptian Air Force is doing very poorly at that point. But not everybody knows that. In fact, the Jordanians don't know that. The citizenry in Israel don't know that yet. Only the Israeli military knows that.
So what time did they move into?
9 o'clock? About 9:30. So Israel has to fight back, and it's not exactly clear where the response will happen. They'll have to repulse the Jordanian onslaught in southern Jerusalem, but where else is there going to be fighting on that first day in the central sector? So Dayan says, we don't want to open up a second front. At most, we can capture the Latrun corridor as a way of getting eventually to Mount Scopus. Now Dayan contradicted himself. On the one hand, he said, I don't want war with Jordan, because after all, they're not really going to invade us. They're just going to have a token assault on a demilitarized section of the city. On the other hand, he says, let's capture Latrun. So throughout the war, this will be an ongoing phenomenon. Dayan is two-faced. He says one thing, he means another, he contradicts himself left and right. In the same sentence, he could say six different things. So, do you want war with Jordan, or do you not? Unclear. Rabin wanted to open up a third front against the Syrians, because on the morning of Monday, June 5th, the northern settlements were being attacked from the air by artillery shells. Dayan refuses and says, as long as the Syrians don't initiate a ground offensive, we do nothing. We do nothing. That's not going to go over well with citizenry in the north. They're going to say, you're leaving us here to die? That we should be exposed to enemy fire and you're going to do nothing about it? So there's a real animosity between the kibbutzim, the members of the kibbutzim and the Galil, and the defense minister over his policy early in the war. Dayan ordered that the IDF not enter Gaza. Why not? Although the Sinai is being invaded on three axes, and the Air Force is bombing away at targets in the Sinai and in Egypt proper, across the canal, and for that matter, in Jordan and Syria and Iraq, was bombed as well that morning. H3, the westernmost air base in Iraq, was bombed. Still, don't go into Gaza. What's wrong with Gaza? There are 250,000 Palestinian refugees there, and no one wants them, and we don't want them either. Therefore, don't go there. If you go there, there'll be inner-city combat, and a lot of our troops will die. What actually happened was that sometime late in the morning, the Palestinian fighters, there are about 1,000 of them, in Gaza, so not Egyptian military, but Palestinian fighters, start firing upon the kibbutzim on the other side of the fence. Or actually, there was no fence, it was just a furrow in those years. And Israel has to go to war against Gaza. And it's heavy-duty fighting, and 70 soldiers died in the raid against Gaza. Now, as things were worsening for the Jordanians, because Israel did push back in southern Jerusalem and did invade the Latrun corridor and did invade in the northern West Bank, as things were souring for the Jordanians, it was no longer a question of whether or not Israel could capture East Jerusalem. It was a foregone conclusion that Israel could, but was it the prudent thing to do so? What are the reasons not to capture East Jerusalem? Why not?
World opinion.
World pressure. Okay, so not just world pressure of threatening, if you do it, there'll be consequences, but also the idea that why would you want to fight for something that you can't hold on to after the fact, that you know you're going to have to give away despite having conquered it? Now, the precedent for that, of course, is the Sinai in the 56 war. It was conquered, but it had to be given back very quickly. So what's the point? Why fight for something that you can't keep? Well, Begin and Yigal Alon pressured Eshkol to have an offensive against Jerusalem on the first day of the war. It would have been possible. could have been done, but Eshkol was reluctant and Dayan was adamantly opposed. Eshkol worried that there'd be a Soviet intervention or censure and embargo from the Christian world because of occupation of the holy places. So you don't want to annoy the Christians, and for sure the Soviets are going to be against us. It was already assumed on the first day of the war that if Israel is successful, relations with the Soviet Union will be severed. And it, in fact, it does happen on the last day of the war. The USSR ambassador comes in and says, we no longer have diplomatic ties. The National Religious Party was very worried about an international backlash if Israel were to conquer holy places. Now, let me repeat that. The National Religious Party, religious Zionists, had the most dovish views of the whole war. And they're horribly afraid of what will the Goyim say if we conquer the holy places. Now, Dayan... I'm not here to defend it. I'm just saying that
I should have had a Torah logic.
No, remember, religious Zionism before 1967 is not really religious Zionism. It's the Zionism of people who happen to be religious. That's a very important point. Religious Zionism in the sense of fundamentalism and conflating religion with politics is a post-Six-Day War phenomenon. Before that, these were just people with Shomer Shabbos and a yarmulke on their head who were Zionists. And Zionists come in all stripes, left, right, and center, and these were left.
It okay. Seems to be a centuries-old way of looking at things.
Yeah.
What are the Goyim going to do?
Right, yeah. It's a pre-modern view of things, to say the least. Now, Dayan came to the Knesset on June 5th in the afternoon to be sworn in as defense minister. Because remember, he had taken office just a few days earlier and had never even been to the Knesset. He had been hanging out in Tel Aviv, and now it was this time to be sworn in. He got there, and the building was deserted. There was no one there. Why? Because Jordanian shells were falling all over the center of the country. So he went back to Tel Aviv. He says, well, there's nothing doing here. What am I going to do? He went back to the Kiryat. Menachem Begin insisted that there be a cabinet meeting that night and that it take place in the Knesset underground shelter. And this was perhaps the most important cabinet meeting in the history of the State of Israel. Why? Because it's at this meeting when they discussed the millennial vision of the fate of the Jewish people, that the capture of the holy places of Yerushalayim. Begin and Alon wanted to capture the Old City, and Alon believed that the Old City could become an indivisible part of the State of Israel, which not everyone believed, but he was convinced should be the case. Eshkol urged caution, fearing that if they captured the Old City too soon, or at all, there could be pressure to give it up, and that would not be good. The National Religious Party, Chaim Moshe Shapira, favored Eshkol's hesitation, and in one of the two most absurd things you're going to hear tonight, I said there were two very absurd things you're going to hear tonight, this is the first one, Shapira said there's going to be pressure to internationalize the city after an Israeli capture, and he said, and I for one won't object to that. Whoa, that doesn't sound very Jewish, doesn't sound very Zionist, and yet he's the head of the National Religious Party, and he says, I will not object to the internationalizing of Jerusalem after we capture it. Yeah.
Was there ever talk of the lines that we had today of unified Jerusalem?
Yes, at the end of the war, it will become...
I'm saying, before going in...
Oh, no, not really. No, one of the most important things to know about the course of events in the Six-Day War is that the government after the fact would conveniently claim that all the attainments had been part of some plan. This was what we wanted. We set out to do the following things. Rubbish. What actually happened is the military operated on expediency, and wherever they could grab, they grabbed. On every front, all three fronts, and the government in hindsight says, yeah, that's what we wanted. Okay. So, Zalman Aran of the Mapai was the most dovish of all the Mapai members of government. He's the education minister, and he sided with Shapira that we should hesitate and not go to the Old City. Mordechai Bentov of the Mapam, interestingly, the Mapam favored Menachem Begin's approach of conquer it right now, an immediate assault on the Old City. Abba Ibn, whose opinion didn't matter all that much, because in fact he wasn't even in Jerusalem, he was in New York, he worried about damage to the holy places. The ministers agreed not to agree. More immediately, they had to silence the Jordanian guns and make sure there aren't further casualties in the central sector of the country. So Dayan acknowledged when the meeting was over that if they really wanted to, they could conquer East Jerusalem on Tuesday, the second day of the war, but he preferred to wait until at least Wednesday. He wanted to finish operations in the Sinai. Now, matters in the Sinai had gone very well. The Air Force strike on the Egyptian Air Force was a tremendous success, and the ground assault was proceeding nicely. I mean, there were some hiccups along the way, but basically it was a winning war. Now, Dayan insisted upon absolute press silence this whole time, because if the international media were aware of Israeli successes on day one of the war too soon, then there'd be pressure for a ceasefire. And he wanted time to conquer more territory, but even more importantly than territory, time to bludgeon the Egyptian military and, for that matter, the Jordanian military. We want to weaken the enemy, and the world opinion will not allow us to do that, so therefore, everything keep quiet, don't let anybody know that we're winning the war. Now, what did the other side claim was happening?
They were winning.
And this was a big disaster for them, because it confused the various parties in the Arab coalition. The Jordanians didn't know that the Egyptians were losing. The Egyptians didn't know that the Jordanians were losing. The Syrians are a non-factor because they're not fighting yet. But even they were claiming great success against downing Israeli jets, and that they were crossing over the border and going to Haifa. This was very, very bad for them. They confused their own people and their own military. Okay, now day two.
But that worked for the Israelis, though, because Israelis were keeping a silence, and the non-truth was being promulgated.
There were some ways to know that the Arab propaganda was in fact propaganda and not real news. So most famously, there was an Israeli diplomat who was told, who was in a hostile country, Israel has lost 500 planes. And he said, that's great news. We don't have 500 planes.
It's the origins of fake news.
Yeah. Okay, so on day two, Tuesday, June 6th, at 1 a.m., Rabin gets on the radio and announces that there's been a tremendous success in operations in the Sinai and that the Egyptian Air Force is kaput. Previously, the Israeli public didn't know. So on the one hand, this boosted morale. On the other hand, it ratcheted up pressure for a ceasefire. You have to balance what's more important. And morale is not insignificant. You have to take that into consideration. Dayan then ordered Rabin to conquer the rest of Gaza and El Arish and press on in the Sinai, but stay at least 4 miles away from the canal. Don't go to the canal. The problem with this, of course, is that Israel didn't have plans for a military adventure in the western portion of the Sinai Peninsula. Even their most aggressive war plans only included what to do on the eastern portion of the peninsula, like a cross-border raid or a thrust of maybe 30, 40 miles. So the soldiers, the officer corps, were winging it. They didn't know what to do other than to keep pressing forward so long as you don't encounter resistance. Okay. Now, on day two, Montegur, in the central sector, and his men want to attack Jerusalem and atone for the sin of 1948. The sin of 1948, that's how it was known. The Avera, that we didn't take the old city and the holy places in the War of Independence. So he wanted to attack via Herod's Gate on the north side of the old city. And the starting off point was the Rockefeller Museum. So if you know your lay of the land, from Rockefeller southward into the Muslim quarter. But Uzi Narkis, who was the head of the central command, refused permission, and Montegur was furious. So therefore, there will not be an attack into the old city proper on day two. Later in the day, towards evening time, there'll be an attack on the Augusta Victoria, which was a failure, and led to some casualties. But as the day progressed on Tuesday, the Egyptians and the Jordanians began movement in the direction of a retreat, a strategic collapse. And they didn't have to. Truth be told, that even with no air force, they could have held on the ground, hunkered down, taken the loss of some territory, but still possessed a large chunk of the territory that it would eventually fall to Israel. Meaning the Egyptians could have salvaged half of Sinai, or maybe even two-thirds of Sinai. And the Jordanians could have salvaged the bulk of the West Bank. But early losses convinced them that they would continue, that they would proceed to lose even further. And so, rather than take a further licking, they just want to get out of there, fall back. Now, the big lie at this point comes into play. What's the big lie?
I'll respect you in the morning.
No, so the big lie is that the Americans, or for that matter, the Americans and the British, were actually fighting on Israel's behalf, and that the pilots were American pilots, not Israeli pilots. Lyndon Johnson was outraged with Nasser, and for that matter Hussein, but especially Nasser, that they would have the chutzpah to make such claims that they knew were false. And why were the Arab leaders doing this? To cover for themselves that they're losing the great battle against the evil Zionists, and they're getting pummeled. It must be that it wasn't the Zionists who were fighting, we're fighting the world superpower, the Americans.
Why would Johnson be upset when they know they tell lies all the time?
Because the big lie gives America a shame, ra, a bad name, and America is interested in maintaining its position as an honest broker, as a neutral arbiter. America doesn't want to be seen as too cozy with the Israelis. Now, yes, Johnson didn't want to see Israel destroyed, and there were, most of the people in the administration, once war was breaking out, they preferred an Israeli victory, but they wanted American neutrality to be preserved.
But they knew Nasser told lies anyway. The whole time was
telling. Understood, but not everyone else thinks that. In other words, in the presence of the United Nations or the Third World or the Latin American ambassadors or the Soviet bloc ambassadors, when Nasser says it was the Americans, they believe it. Or they pretend to believe it. So it's not good for everyone to be saying the Americans did this on behalf of the Israelis.
But the Russians were still on the side of Egypt.
That's so, okay.
No. Yep. But I'm saying if the word got out that the Americans were helping Israel,
then there's a concern
Russia
of Soviet intervention.
Right.
So Soviet intervention was threatened on day five of the war, but it never really amounted to anything. Kosygin sent an angry letter to Eshkol, but it was ignored. It was ignored. Okay. So late in the day on Tuesday, there is an attempt to attack East Jerusalem, but not the Old City, the Augusta Victoria section, not too far from Mount Scopus, to the northeast of the city. And it failed. This was an attempt to encircle the city, the Old City, without having to attack it directly. The thinking was, if you could surround the Old City, then maybe there wouldn't even be a need for a battle. You could just have them wave the white flag if they would so choose, and save lives. Ultimately, the city was never surrounded completely. The attack, which happens on Wednesday, on day three, happens even before the city is fully encircled. Yeah?
Was West Jerusalem evacuated, or was it
in all? No. Although, I should have mentioned this last week, when Meir Amit, the head of the Mossad, left to go to Washington incognito with a fake mustache on May 31st, he was very disappointed that on the plane he saw many VIPs who were leaving the country, who were getting out to save themselves, not knowing that Israel would ultimately win the war. And that's disconcerting when a country that's supposed to be patriotic and heroic has some of their better citizens disappearing off to New York or wherever when it's dangerous. It doesn't say, but Michael Oren's book and several other books mention that, and Amit's memoirs mention that he saw certain people who shouldn't have been leaving. All right. Now, late in the day on Tuesday, Yigal Alon pressures the government to start another front of war against Syria, because he is the champion of the kibbutzim of the north. Now, bear in mind, where does he come from? He comes from Ginosar. But then again, where does Moshe Dayan come from? Nahalal. Where does Levi Eshkol come from? Degania. They all come from the north. But yet Dayan, despite being a northerner, says, no, we're not going to go to war. No war. You have to just keep taking the bombings and be quiet. Eshkol basically favored going to war with Syria. He wanted the headwaters of the Jordan. He wanted the Banyas, because water was a big deal to Eshkol. Remember, Eshkol was the builder of the national water carrier. And to him, gaining access to the tributaries of the Jordan up in the Syrian territory would have been a great thing. But he's afraid to contradict Dayan, and he doesn't want to make a decision without cabinet approval, so he's waiting. But in theory, he agrees with this approach. Zalman Aran, ever the pacifist, Chaim Moshe Shapira, ever the pacifist, and Dayan all oppose going to war against Syria. So Dayan tried to explain why it is that he opposes that war. He said, Egypt, we're afraid of Egypt, because even though they're far away, they're very strong. And he says, we're afraid of the Jordanians, because even though they're weak, they're very close. But Syria is both weak and far away. So what do we have to worry about? We don't need to go to war. Is that a compelling logic? Well, it may be for the country as a whole, but it's not going to warm the hearts of those who are suffering under the guns.
Right, Syria was still, that might be far away, but they're still shooting.
Exactly, yeah.
That's far. Why is Syria far? The Golan was held by Syria then.
The argument was that the population centers were far from the Syrian military. The Syrian military was not so heavily concentrated on the Golan, which they weren't, at least not yet. And that who matters? The people in Tel Aviv, not the people who live up north. Yeah.
They advanced into Kibbutz Dan. My cousin led the battle, and he saved the whole area.
Right. So there's so we're going to see that the Syrians make an abortive attempt at invading with a relatively small force, and it failed, and it failed, and that's why they didn't have a main thrust, because the early attempt was unsuccessful. So. Dayan warned the cabinet members, especially Alon, Galili, and Moshe Carmel, that when it comes to security matters, there's no democracy. Israel is not a democracy. He says, there's no democracy in security matters. I'm the boss. I'm the defense minister. I'm the boss. Now, and he threatened to quit if they meddled in security affairs. Is this really the way it worked? No. In fact, there was a ministerial defense committee, which was a subset of the cabinet, that was supposed to vote on operations throughout the course of the war. And Dayan has one vote, maybe an important vote, but not the only vote. And yet now he's saying, I'm the boss, don't push me on to do this or that or the other thing, I'll decide, I'll make all the decisions. Okay, get your question.
Didn't it make any difference to them that the Galilee really took a battery, I mean, when it started?
So it bothered members of the government that they didn't want to see this continue, and they wanted to silence the Syrian guns, but not everyone was ready to go for a full-scale war until they were ready on day five.
The Galilee was mostly fields.
Right. It's not heavily populated. Okay.
Do they have the troops for southern and northern?
So that's one of the considerations. Is the manpower available? Is the equipment available? Helicopters in particular. And the answer is, they will become available when the other fronts are concluded. So by day five, pretty much everything is available. All right. Now, Dayan, as I said, he's always contradicting himself. So he said, no war against Syria, but if you want to, you can take the DMZ, the demilitarized zones that are on the border. Rabin then called for taking the DMZ, the Banyas, and taking some POWs. Why POWs? Because we'll trade them for Israeli pilots who get captured when they get shot out of the sky flying over Syria. Which will be very important, because for the first time in Israel's history, in the Yom Kippur War will be much more significant, but in the Six-Day War also, you have a nice number of POWs who have to be taken into account. And it's not so simple to extract them after the war to make trades. David Elazar, Dado, as he was known, was the commander of the Northern Front. He's upset that no action is happening. Every commander wants their sector to be busy. Number one, because they feel for the population there, and also because they know if this is a victorious war, they want some of the cover, the glory that's involved. On the Central Front, Dayan wants the conquest of the Jordan Valley, but not yet of the Old City. So what does he say late in the day on the second day? I want none of that Vatican. He refers to the Old City as the Vatican. This was not exactly the nicest line that he had. The ministerial committee met at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The pressure was building for a ceasefire. There was a concern that if you don't attack now the Old City, the ceasefire will prevent it from ever happening. And another opportunity, a tremendous opportunity, will be lost. So Eshkol suggested, what do? we take the old city and then immediately convene all the religious leaders and give them control over the holy places, which is what basically would happen. Begin wanted the national military and civilian leaders to just walk, march on the Western Wall and offer a prayer for peace. Now that wasn't going to happen. That's a pie-in-the-sky Menachem Begin type suggestion. That we're just going to waltz on in and daven at the Kotel. Alon said, take the city and be done with it. Galili said, do it without fanfare. In other words, let's not make a big to-do. If we don't make a big to-do, maybe people will just, the international community won't raise a fuss. Shapira said, ever the pacifist, that we should appeal to the Christian and Muslim leaders around the world to persuade King Hussein to surrender without a fight. Again, pie-in-the-sky idea that wasn't going to happen. Dayan said to Ben-Gurion, we shouldn't conquer the holy places because we're going to have to give them up under force of sanctions later. Herzog, Yaakov Herzog, told Eben, don't put forth any diplomatic proposals right now. Why? Because we still haven't figured out what we want to do with the old city. Our plans are not yet certain, but you, Eben, could ruin things by getting to diplomacy too soon. So yes, everyone loves peace and diplomacy, but not right now. Hold off. Not yet, not yet. Eben then went to the Security Council and gave one of the greatest speeches in the history of the world. I wasn't born yet, but most of you were. And you probably saw it on TV. It was shown in the stations in New York. And his famous line was, what would you do? How long would you wait if your country was in a similar predicament? The cabinet met again late on Tuesday. And at this point, they begin thinking about what's going to happen if we take control over the whole West Bank? What do we do with it? So June 6, 1967, at 11 p.m. at night, is the first time the Israeli government ever starts thinking to themselves, wow, we might win, and then we don't know what to do next. We haven't thought about this. This is not in the plans.
Candidate.
Okay, exactly. Day 3. So the threat of the ceasefire is imminent. Dayan finally says, okay, attack the old city. Get to the holy place, the Jewish holy places, ASAP. So the chain of command goes Dayan to Rabin to Barlev to Narkis to Mutagur, in that order. Mutagur gets the order, and he's ready to roll. At this point, Begin doesn't know that the order was given. So he starts pestering Dayan to give the order. And Dayan says, I don't need your advice. I gave the order already. In other words, be quiet. Enough, Menachem. Quiet down. Menachem Begin didn't contribute much during the war other than just enthusiasm and he's a go-getter telling everybody else, we got to do it. But he's not doing himself anything. He's just a minister without portfolio. Okay. Then there was a telegram from Secretary of State Dean Rusk, saying the Americans don't look favorably upon an assault on the old city. They want an immediate ceasefire, or they want you to halt your progress. So what's going to happen now? Shall Israel give in to the American State Department and what is seen as a White House request for no further military action? Or do you keep going?
Why should they, after Johnson promised A, B, and C?
And gave nothing. Right, so that's a good good counter-argument. Now, Rav Shlomo Goren, the chief rabbi of the military, made it his business to be at the center of the action. Wherever the action was, he was going to be there. And so he goes over to Jerusalem and is near the old city right before the decision is made to attack. And he bumps into Mutagur. And he says, history will never forgive you if you don't attack. History will never forgive you. Then he bumps into Chaim Herzog, not Yaakov Herzog, but Chaim Herzog. And he says to him, if you can convince the government to issue the order to attack, I guarantee you a place in Olam Haba. So to Mutagur he said, history won't forgive you. To Chaim Herzog, he was more respectful. You get a place in Gan Eden, you know.
Chaim Herzog and Vichus.
Yes, well, as the son of the chief rabbi, talking to the next chief rabbi. So Eshkol decides, okay, go ahead. We're not going to hold back just because of the American telegram. The assault commences through the Lion's Gate. Narkis is on the radio and he hears Mutagur say, Harabayit Biadenu. We have the Harabayit. Good. Then Eshkol wants to go to the Western Wall, but there's still sniper fire, so his security detail tells him, don't go yet. It's not safe. It's still very dangerous. And yet, by 2:30, Dayan Rabin and Nakis are entering the old city. Famous photograph of the three of them, the three generals, and they steal all the glory. So Eshkol doesn't get the big cover that he was the victorious prime minister, and yet the generals are for posterity the ones who won the war. Eshkol shows up 2 hours later and puts a note in the wall. What are the various proposals at this point? So Dayan says, let's tear down some of the old city wall, the wall of Suleiman, just as conquerors have always torn down portions of the wall. In keeping with long-standing military tradition, let's tear a little bit down. Did that happen?
No.
What's the only portion of the wall that's ever been torn down? By Jaffa Gate. And who tore it down?
Clock tower is gone.
But the wall proper by the Jaffa Gate is the only section. It was torn down in 1898 to make room for the Kaiser. Okay, so Rav Goren said, blow up the mosques because Mashiach is coming. Then Begin said, repopulate the Jewish quarter right away. Now, it's impossible to repopulate it right away. It takes time. The shikum of the Jewish quarter was from 1967 to 1983. You just look at the sign when you walk into the Jewish quarter. You'll see what it says. So it takes a long time. But Begin, ever ready to offer ridiculous suggestions, said, right away, put 4,000 Jews in the old city. Yigal Yadin says, let's conquer Hebron. Now, Yadin, the archaeologist, the student of history, the lover of the land of Israel, is in favor of reconnecting with the places of the Jewish past. You know, we have a connection to the Hebron since the days of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So Eshkol says to him, yeah, but a lot of Arabs there. Who needs the Arabs? And so Yadin responded, we'll just invade and they'll run away to the desert. They'll flee. Now, did that actually happen? Yeah. No, it didn't happen. Ayom Hazeh is a big Arab, Hebron is a big Arab city. But it goes to show Yadin was connected to the past. Then, on the Egyptian front, Operation Lights, the conquest of Sharm el-Sheikh. In the early phases of the war, Rabin didn't want to go that far south. Sharm el-Sheikh is very far south. I mean, it takes a long time to get there. And it wasn't the most important thing. So long as the Straits of Tehran could be opened, you didn't have to necessarily occupy the southernmost reaches. But now it was determined, we got to do it. So they go, and they prepare a naval assault. Unexpectedly, Sharm el-Sheikh was empty. There was no one there, or almost no one there. The Egyptians had already given up. So the tip of the Sinai Peninsula was occupied, as were the islands of Tiran and Snapir, Sanafir in English, which is a good trivia question because it's an example of Israel occupying Saudi territory. It belonged to Saudi Arabia, not to Egypt. Huh? No, all the way south. All the way down, the bottom, yeah.
Yeah. The big deal was it was the oil fields down there.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, and Israel was going to steal the oil. Steal the oil.
You can't do that.
But they tried. They tried. So, with this in mind, that you're going to conquer the bulk of the Sinai, Dayan says, don't go past the Mitla and Gidi passes, which are the two ways to get from the western portion of the peninsula further inland. Don't go any further. Stay there. We'll hold down the fort at the Mitla and Gidi passes. We don't have to go to the canal. The IDF stopped taking Egyptian prisoners because they had too many. They didn't have food and water for them. It just said, keep walking. You're an Egyptian, keep walking. If you're a general, we'll capture you. We'll take your POW. But if you're a nobody, keep walking and swim across the canal. The Russians sent a threatening letter at this point saying, stop taking Egyptian territory. It's enough. But Israel ignored it. It was insufficiently threatening. It was too vague. And when something is vague, it loses its force, its potency. Well, at this point, the cabinet gets together and says, we've got to start talking peace. Yigal Alon says, we can make peace deals with Jordan, Lebanon, and Morocco. Now, why Jordan, Lebanon, and Morocco? Number one, because Morocco was the only nominally, the non-anti-Semitic Arab state. The king had decent enough relations with Israel. Why Lebanon? Because Lebanon wasn't part of the war. And really, there's no good reason why a Christian Lebanon can't be at peace with Israel. And why Jordan? Because Hussein needs it. Otherwise, it's curtains for him. Alon then said,
they going to the West Bank already?
Yes.
They,
not the totality of the West Bank, but significant portions of it. So Yigal Alon said, if King Hussein doesn't want to make peace with us, so on the third day of the war, then he and his family can take a plane to England and have refuge there. In other words, there's no more Hashemite dynasty. If he doesn't make peace, out. We'll kick him out of the Middle East. That's chutzpah. But you know what? Yigal Alon had a lot of chutzpah. And did it work out that way? No. In the end, the Hashemite dynasty continued and didn't make peace with Israel, not for another 25 years, not until after the PLO did. But relations with Jordan improved so that there was working cooperation in the late 60s, early 70s against the PLO. Okay. Meir Amit, the head of the Mossad, then asks the question, what are we planning to do with the West Bank? Are we going to annex it, or do we have other ideas? Well, what were the other ideas? Eshkol said, we're going to separate the East Bank from the West Bank and have local autonomy on the West Bank. Local autonomy. Under our military control, but local autonomy. What about Gaza, they asked. Eshkol's response, Gaza is a bone in our throats. We don't know what to do. There's no ready solution to Gaza. And there never will be. Okay? Then, late in the day on June 7th, you have the first crack in the U.S.-Israeli consensus. Remember I said that although Johnson didn't really want Israel to fight further and to conquer more territory, the Americans favored an Israeli victory on the assumption that after an Israeli victory there could be a trade of land for peace. But late in the day, on the third day of the war, that breaks down because already the Israelis are talking about holding on to territory long term. Which territories? So first Sharm el-Sheikh, that there shouldn't be ever a blocking of the Straits of Tehran again, that even if there's the rest of the Sinai is returned, the tip of the Sinai will remain in Israeli control. The second thing is the narrow waist of Israel along the West Bank shall be expanded. Instead of being Israel 11 miles wide, we'll make it 13, 14, 15 miles wide. We'll move the green line in to the east. And lastly, united Jerusalem. That all the Israelis are talking about is we're going to hold on to Jerusalem forever, forever. So that troubles the Americans because you know, the Americans need to hear that we're going to trade all the territory for all the peace. Okay.
To what end? Again, after 56, it would be just a question of repeating the same
thing? So the answer is that in 56, the territory was relinquished without a peace deal. The Americans now understood that the Israelis are not going to do that unless there is a signed accord, face-to-face negotiations with promises of normalizing of relations. Of course, that won't happen because the Arabs oppose that, but that's what the Americans are hoping for. Okay, now, the Israelis across the world, the ambassadors and consuls general who are having to explain the Israeli position to host governments, find themselves in a bit of a jam because Israel is conquering more and more territory, and all the other world governments want to know, well, when are you going to stop? And what do you think you're going to hold on to? So Ehud Avriel was the ambassador to Rome, to Italy. And the Vatican, which didn't have relations with Israel at the time, doesn't until 1993, called him in for consultation. And he said, listen, it was long ago determined that Jerusalem belongs to Israel. 1,000 years before Jesus and 2,000 years before Muhammad, it was a foregone conclusion that Israel owns Jerusalem. And the Vatican better find a way to reconcile itself with it. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. You know, that's what he said to him. All right, so let's go to day 4, Thursday, June 8. By midday, Jordan is no longer Jordan. It's back to being Transjordan. There is no West Bank anymore. Israel controls all of historic British Mandate Palestine. Rabin is now ready to reach the canal. So the central sector is finished, and the southern sector is almost finished. Dayan wants Nasser's downfall. But he doesn't want to go to the canal. So interestingly, he's willing to bomb the Cairo airport, hoping to foment rebellion against Nasser, that he should be ousted and executed. But he doesn't want to go to the canal. Yet, what happens? Things on the ground have a life of their own. And Israel gets to the canal, whether the defense minister wanted it or not. But it should be noted that in the glory of victory, and in the fog of jubilation over victory, Israel neglected to do something very important in Sinai. Israel did not conquer the entire Sinai. They neglected to take Port Fa'ud, which is opposite Port Said. It's the eastern side of the entrance to the Suez Canal. They left it in Egyptian hands, and it remained so all throughout. The relevance of that is it facilitated Soviet resupply of the Egyptian military after the war. Had Israel actually occupied that section of the port, the Soviets may have had a much harder time restocking the Egyptians. Okay. Why go all the way to the canal? So the southern generals, in part, are concerned that the glory is going to go to Uzinakis and Matagur for conquering Yerushalayim. What are we going to get? We, who really won the war, because the war was really against Egypt, and we're the victorious generals, we have no glory, no covered. So what? We'll go all the way to the canal. That will be our covered. All right. Then, what about on the Syrian front? On the Syrian front, Dayan holds the line, says, listen, the army did whatever they did in the West Bank, irrespective of my instructions. The army did whatever they did in the Sinai, sometimes against my instructions. But there will be nothing on the northern front without my instructions. Nothing. So the cabinet has to debate it again, late in the fourth day. Zalman Aran, ever the pacifist, said, if we attack Syria, the whole world will be against us. Shapira and Zerachor Haftik from the Narapi agreed, we can't attack Syria, the Goyim will be against us. Yigal Alon said, we have to go to war with Syria, we have to silence the guns on the heights, and don't worry, we don't need to occupy the Golan Heights. What can we do? We can set up a Druze state. Now, it never happened. A Druze state is like as fanciful as a Kurdish state, you know, in Iraq. The two peoples that always get stabbed in the back, the Kurds and the Druze. Okay, so that was his idea. Eshkol didn't know what to do. But Dayan had the deciding vote, and Dayan says, let's delay 2 days. Now, delaying 2 days means not doing it at all. Because by 48 hours is an eternity in the Six-Day War. I mean, they don't call it the Six-Day War for nothing. So what is he really trying to do? He's trying to avoid going to war with Syria. Then permission was granted to take Tel Azaziat, which was like one bunker up the cliffs. And Dado and Rabin both said, what's the point of taking one bunker? If we're going to expose our forces to fire as they climb up the bluffs, we might as well take the whole Golan Heights, not just take one little sliver of it. So Eshkol really wants to go to war. Dayan is obstinate. Eshkol's wife, Miriam, says to Dado, she says, I have a birthday coming up. You know what I want for my birthday? I want the banyas. I want the banyas. So Dado says, well, then you have to tell your husband to make the decision, to elbow Dayan and tell him, let's get going. Eben, in America, gets an inkling that the Americans are okay with an assault on Syria, at least a limited one, that the Syrians have been bad actors, have been participating in the big lie, maybe they should get their comeuppance. The fourth day of the war was also the day of the USS Liberty. We're not going to spend more than 10 seconds on the USS Liberty because it doesn't really matter for our purposes. Suffice it to say, reports of the internal Israeli commissions to study it, three of them, all came to the conclusion it was an innocent mistake. The big question is, what was the Liberty doing there to begin with? Was it spying? Was it spying on Israel? The more malicious theories are that it was spying on Israel. Israel had what to conceal, and therefore Israel bombed it on purpose. This doesn't hold water. I don't think that's what happened. I think that either it was an innocent mistake, or someone in the chain of command did something that they shouldn't have. But I don't think that Israel as a government or as the IDF as a whole intended to do damage to the Americans. Okay, the ministerial committee met, 34 sailors died. Yeah. So the ministerial committee met again late on Thursday. And the question is, go to war against Syria and lose relations with the Russians, or maintain relations with the Russians and don't go to war with Syria and let Syria maintain the Golan? It's an interesting question, but ultimately Alon says, forget the Russians, we need to go to war. There was a concern that war with Syria would result in Israel's expulsion from the UN. Why? Because the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc, the Asian countries, and the African countries might all turn against Israel and call for its expulsion. All right. Then Dayan said something that is the most egregious thing said in the course of the whole war. I said there were two crazy things tonight. One was Shapira's, I'll favor internationalizing Jerusalem. Now Dayan, he said, I prefer to move the settlements 10 or 20 miles from the Syrian artillery rather than get caught up in a third front in a clash with the Soviets. Thousands of Arabs were relocated in this war. We can relocate several dozen Israelis. That did not sit well with the rest of the cabinet. They were so angry with him that he would say such a thing. It was the most tense moment in the course of the war from the cabinet's point of view. They were aghast. How could Moshe Dayan, who comes from the Galilee, say, we're just going to move everything back, 20 miles so nobody gets hurt? It's contrary to all of Zionism and the notion of the modern Jew sticking up for himself. To collapse backward in the face of a couple of rockets from Syria? Okay, so Eshkol ends the meeting by saying, it would be a pity if the Syrians got away scot-free. Which was his nice way of saying, we're going to go to war. In the morning, in the wee hours of the morning, Dayan changed his mind. With Sinai finished, and the ceasefire on the verge of being implemented, this was the last chance to take the Golan. Also, the reports were coming in that the Syrian military on the Golan was collapsing backward. Turns out that wasn't really true. So Dayan tells Dado, go to war. Now what happened was, the cabinet never authorized it. It was just a decision by Moshe Dayan by himself. So Eshkol finds out about it and says, that's despicable. How could he, one man, decide to go to war with another country? We, the Ministerial Defense Committee, which is authorized to do these things, never gave permission. So do you rescind the order? Does Eshkol, as the Prime Minister, say, call them all back?
But what were the votes?
There was no vote.
Now, what would the votes have been?
Who knows?
But he wanted to do it anyway.
Okay, so Eshkol doesn't call it back. He says, all right, once the troops are on the move, they're on the move. He doesn't reverse it. The Syrian bunkers held out much better than was anticipated, and there are heavy casualties. Johnson, turns out, wasn't happy about this, and Johnson said about Eshkol, quote, that old coot isn't going to pay any attention to imperialist pressure, meaning not American pressure, not Soviet pressure. So the theory that Johnson favored a war against the Syrians was incorrect. He didn't. Okay. By 8 p.m., the situation was not good. The Security Council had convened and was pressuring for a ceasefire. The Soviets were threatening Israel. The Americans were displeased, and that casualty count was very high. So, what do you do? Shapira and Barzilai in the cabinet said, halt the offensive.
This is Friday?
This is Friday evening. Right. So Friday night, Shabbos already started. The cabinet is meeting. The Mapam minister and the NRP minister says, halt the offensive and get Dayan in trouble for authorizing something without the cabinet's permission. Who gave him the right to do such a thing? Alon said, keep fighting. Galili said, keep fighting. Even if there's a ceasefire, keep fighting. That's what Galili said. Begin said, although there was an aesthetic violation of the rules of democracy here with Dayan's decision, really, he was just exercising his prerogative. So Menachem Begin was Malamud Zchus to Moshe Dayan for violating the democratic procedures because Menachem Begin wanted war. So good old Menachem, he doesn't really do anything in this whole conflict other than run his mouth a little bit in a sort of not a joking way, but what looks like a humorous way. Yaakov Herzog then says, it's better we have a rupture with Moscow than for the Syrians to retain the Golan. Let the army continue fighting. So the committee decided the army could continue fighting until daybreak, Saturday morning. But in the daylight hours, no more fighting. It's too dangerous. David Elazar, then, on Saturday morning, day 6, who was told by Rabin, call your forces back in the southern Golan, said, what can I do? They've already left the station. Now, meaning, they're going to fight. I don't care what you tell me, they're going to fight. So day 6, there's an erosion of Israel's moral position because of its refusal to clarify to the U.S. what its territorial ambitions are in the Golan. The Soviet Union breaks ties with Israel. The ambassador comes to the foreign minister and says, you know, we hereby sever ties with you. And the ambassador cries. Why does he cry? Because he knows he's in big trouble. He was called back to Moscow and then exiled to Siberia. Now, this was not the Stalinist era anymore, but still, people got exiled to Siberia. So his failure to impose anything upon the Israelis led to his personal suffering in the gulags. Okay, was it still worth fighting? So the Northern Command wanted more time, and Dayan agreed to give them until 2 p.m. If it was 10 a.m., you have till 2 p.m. But after 2 p.m., don't ask for any help, not even for air cover. I'm not going to give it to you. 95,000 Syrian civilians fled the Golan. Were they forced out? No. Most of them never even encountered an Israeli soldier. They fell backward with the Syrian troops. Who stayed behind? The Druze and the Circassians, who had kinsmen who lived in Israel and were loyal Israelis. Quneitra was taken at 12:30 p.m. And this is another example where Arab lies cost them. The Syrians said Quneitra had fallen at 9 in the morning. It hadn't. But because everyone thought that it had, people were falling backward. And Israel was able to take it almost without a fight. Dado wanted a big thrust into Syria. And there was Operation Garzen, which was never implemented, of an Israeli conquest of Damascus. Not too far away.
What was that absurd?
Nothing. But Rabin said, forget about it. We're not doing that. No way. No way.
40 miles.
40 miles, yeah. So they need more time. Dayan does something interesting. Pulls a stunt. Udbul, the general who was the UN representative in Israel, was going to be the recipient of the ceasefire paperwork. So Dayan calls him and says, we're going to have a meeting at 2 o'clock in Tiberias. Now, Bull was in Jerusalem. He's got to take a helicopter up to Tiberias. How long does that take? It takes a little while, you know, to get there. Then when he gets to Tiberias, he gets out of the helicopter, and he's informed, no, the meeting was rescheduled for Tel Aviv. So now it's going to be 3 o'clock in Tel Aviv. You've got to take another helicopter back to Tel Aviv. So they bought an hour with a stunt. Now in that hour, you could conquer more territory. And the ceasefire was ultimately agreed for 6 p.m. 6 p.m. But this was the deal. No UN observers were allowed to observe the fact of the ceasefire. The UN would have to take Israel's word for it. Which means that Israel could use various strategies to gain position up to the last minute and even beyond the last minute. So on the Golan, cooks and janitors were given helmets and sent to forward positions because the fighting had actually stopped. But the line will be wherever the most forward Israeli is. So you send them a few hundred yards further and you plant a flag. The Mount Hermon actually was not taken until Sunday, day 7 of the 6-day war. The flag was planted, you know, helicopter up to the top, Sunday afternoon, and that became part of Israel. So this was the end of the war. With the war over, the question is what to do now. And there's a lot of jubilation, excitement. You know, Hebrew University is going to go back to Mount Scopus, and there's going to be a big ceremony, and Rabin is going to get an honorary doctorate, and all the heavy hitters are going to be sitting in the audience, and he's going to give a speech. Good, fine. But on June 19th, the cabinet gets together, and they decide, in a secret decision, passed by a vote of one, majority of one, I think the vote was like, 9-8, that Israel is ready to give up the Sinai and the Golan Heights for complete peace with Syria and Egypt. But no decision made on the West Bank, because it was too contentious of an issue. The consensus was, and this was not voted upon, but it was just a consensus, that Jerusalem remain the United Capital of Israel. What about the various players in the cabinet? What were their personal positions? Eban opposed a Palestinian state, then later approved of it. Aaron, Shapira, and David Ben-Gurion, who's not in the cabinet, is in the opposition, favored giving away everything except for Jerusalem. Give away all the territories except for Jerusalem. Yigal Alon voted against the June 19th cabinet decision. He favored settlements, but not settlement everywhere, only settlement in strategic locations where there aren't a lot of Arabs. Okay? Begin wanted to keep all the territories. Dayan had five different opinions in one sentence. His most famous line was, "I'm waiting for the phone to ring." In other words, he's hoping for peace, but it isn't coming. But yet he contradicts that by saying, "Let's settle in densely Arab-populated areas," which would then preclude the possibility of a peace arrangement. Eshkol wanted an independent Palestinian entity in the West Bank, but he had trouble finding local Arabs who would participate in this kind of a self-rule arrangement. And he didn't want the PLO, and he didn't want the Jordanians either. So there isn't a very ready solution. There are a lot of different opinions. But, and I'll stop the text.